Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jo.
And welcome to podcast 2B from series 3. Last podcast, we discussed building a relationship. That was podcast 2A, and that was part of our A series, which is about the social work journey and how we work with people from the start of an encounter with them, from first contact right through to transitions or endings. And this podcast is the second one of our B podcasts, which is where we look at what we can learn from other disciplines. And we were just saying, actually, because we are learning from disciplines outside of social work, there's lots of things that we're taking from that, but we're really open to the idea that we might take things incorrectly or misunderstand things or come up with things that people just don't agree with. And we would want to know if that happens. So
definitely.
Yeah. Do let us know what you think. You can download all the podcasts from www.helpfulsocialwork.com or from iTunes. And on both of those sites, you can also comment and let us know what you're listening to and what struck you as interesting or potentially misleading.
Yes. And today we'll be talking about counselling. And I think this is a really useful area to think about in terms of social work. It's an aligned discipline, but one that considers itself to be a very separate profession. And when we think about what social workers think, I've often heard them state that they're not counsellors, or sometimes even that they don't have counselling skills. And I'm going to start the podcast by stating I beg to differ. I think that counselling skills are part and parcel of what we deliver as social workers. And although they're not the only skills we use, they're really critical in terms of engagement, relationship building, and creating and sustaining behaviour change in individuals.
Yeah, I actually studied counselling. I learned about counselling when I was doing my social work course. It was part of the course to get a sense of it.
Yes, and I think that's right. And so as a social worker, I definitely learned it in my course. And also when I did my residential care certificate, which was the first thing I ever did, we learned about counselling there. And then later when I did counselling, a counselling course itself, that kind of helped me click it all together as to how it looks. And I think an interesting thing to start with is the definitions. And what I find really interesting, if you go to the dictionary and look up the definition, it is to give advice, to advise. It comes from Latin and it means debate, advise, advisory body and plan. And I think this is really interesting because one of the key things that the counselling profession is at pains to emphasise is that the primary difference between themselves as counsellors and other professions like social work who utilise counselling skills is that they do not give advice, but that they believe in the ability of individuals to find their own solutions. And if you look at the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy's definition, they talk about boundary time for people to explore and solve their own problems. And that definition, after that definition, they go on to say, it is not giving advice, giving support, offering ideas or solutions.
So in that sense, it's similar maybe to strength-based approaches in social work, where we're increasingly encouraged to look at what solutions and strengths the person has themselves to offer.
Yes, if we look a little bit more about what counsellors, well, you know, when counselling started to really define itself as a body and a profession in 1986, once again, the British Association was one of the first bodies to start to publish definitions. And they said, counselling is the skilled and principal use of relationship to facilitate self-knowledge, emotional acceptance and growth, and the optimal development of personal resources. They went on to say that the overall aim is to provide an opportunity to work towards living more satisfyingly and resourcefully. If I could just say, I love that. Mm. I think that is a social work aim as well. That counselling relationships will vary according to need, but may be concerned with developmental issues, addressing and resolving specific problems, making decisions, coping with a crisis, developing personal insight and knowledge, working through feelings of inner conflict, improving relationships with others. The counsellor's role is to facilitate the client's work in ways that respect the client's values, personal resources, and capacity for self-determination.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities,
Yeah, and the last point I guess I'd like to make there is that counselling as a profession is not regulated by the government. And that to me is an interesting difference there, self-regulated.
It's an interesting point about that maybe links back to the way that society sees the two professions, as well as what they actually are. And just thinking about why we picked this topic, having just talked about building relationships in our last podcast, social work is about advice, which is the root of the word counselling, although from what you've already said, that's a little different to what counsellors are doing. It is also about healing, and it is therapeutic, and I think we quite often forget the social work role as a therapeutic role, and social work as a therapeutic service in its own right, and think that we're about finding out what people need and arranging other services rather than we ourselves offering something. So I suppose just from those points of view of the counsel and the therapy, we're already incorporating some ideas from counselling profession, and yeah, it does really fit with what we talked about last time about using a relationship as both a means to achieve outcomes and also as a therapeutic end in itself. And yeah, the other thing that that is worth mentioning at this point, I think, is that the Code of Ethics and Professional Development Framework for counsellors and psychotherapists also have some quite similar parallels, don't they? Particularly around the ethics. I mean, you just mentioned about in that definition that counselling is the skilled and principled use of relationship, and that strong emphasis on ethics is very familiar to us as well, that, you know, we've got similar value bases around putting people first, empowering people, ethically using our knowledge, being really accountable, and practicing within, from the sounds of it, a kind of a rights framework, in that we're looking at the person's own capacity to self-determine and live their life. And that is really linked to our human rights approach, I think.
And definitely, and the Counselling Code of Ethics actually mentions attending to human rights as well. Okay. I think there's some really lovely work. Anyone who takes an interest in this, actually looking at the Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy's ethics is a really worthwhile thing to do. There's lots and lots, I think, of similarities.
Yeah.
For me, where I think the key tension arises is the way that we approach the conversation with our clients, many of whom are not entering the relationship with us in a voluntary basis. And that really creates a tension between our two professions, because social workers tend to mix counselling with a kind of more directive and helping activities. And counselling ethics really wouldn't support people working with people who were not wanting to engage with them. So, you know, the key thing here is that if you are a counsellor, you are offering your services to somebody who is taking them freely. And sometimes when we are social workers, we are giving services to people who actually don't want to receive them, for many reasons, sometimes because of how they feel about what receiving those services says about them, and sometimes because they perceive those services to be invasive and can have distressing consequences.
Yeah.
So I think the real challenge for us today is to think about how can a social worker utilise the skills of talking therapies and of creating safe psychological spaces for people to work through their own issues, alongside our agenda of safeguarding? And can the tensions be managed in a way that is respectful and helpful to the client and don't come across as confusing or manipulative? Mm. Because you can't pretend to offer one thing if it's actually not in your remit to offer it. Now, these rules are similar for counselling as well, actually. So when I was a school counsellor, the first thing I used to tell young people who would come and talk to me was that there are certain things that if you say them, I cannot keep secret. So that they knew right from the start where my boundaries were. But for social work, those boundaries are even smaller and more constraining, aren't they? Because we often come in with an agenda.
Yeah, and I think it's a little different between adults and children. So just want to take a slight tangent to talk about that, because what you've just said really strikes a chord for me in adult social work about, for example, working with people who are neglecting their own care or their own environment, and there's harm coming from that. Because in those cases, traditionally, we've kind of tried to go in and help, but actually you can't be helpful without offering the therapeutic relationship and understanding why the person is choosing to live in those ways, and understanding where the boundary is between choice and kind of lack of choice or habit or unconscious lack of choice. And so with self-neglect, for example, provided the person has capacity, what you're doing is you're trying to work around the causes of it in a therapeutic way so that you can then be helpful. And even when someone doesn't have capacity to make a decision as an adult and they want to make a decision that might cause harm to themselves, you would still act in their best interest, which would include taking a view on what their wishes had been previously. So you might still, the courts have found for happiness over safety. And I think that's quite different in some ways to the way that we might have to work with, particularly with parents who might be harming their children, but also with adults who are harming other adults, which can happen, you know, for example, in a safeguarding situation, relationship where there's some harm or neglect occurring, because then you are having to be more interventionist, maybe against people's wishes because of the harm to another person. But I think you still need to understand where that's come from, don't you? So you still need the therapeutic element before you can
kind of definitely act. Completely. And I would like to think that we can manage these tensions, because for me, practicing therapeutically has so much to offer. And as you've just pointed out, is actually, I still think that it's the best way to get to a place where there is sustainable, meaningful, and truly valued change for an individual.
Yeah.
I would argue that there's actually room for this approach in social work, and I don't think that I'm alone or original voice here. I think if you look at Harry Ferguson's book on child protection practice, uses the therapeutic idea of containment to provide safe spaces for conversations that support parents to explore their own landscape. Signs of safety, particularly if it's used as it was originally intended, is a really therapeutic method of promoting difficult conversations in safety between family members. Susie Essick's work, which contributed to Signs of Safety, is based on a family therapy model. And Margot Sunderland's Conversations That Matter, Talking with Children and Teenagers, really promotes the use of skilled listening and talking therapies for all professionals who encounter children and young people who are struggling. And if we look at Lefebvre's model of being, knowing and doing, it's a really useful framework to think about the similarities between social work and counselling. This is from her book, Direct Work, Social Work with Children and Young People. And she talks about being as the worker's emotional capacities and capabilities to form relationships, be warm and caring, be self-aware, work with strong feelings and their value base, and the ethical commitment that they make, so they're attending to client rights as well as their needs and sharing power appropriately. And I think that was what you were touching on when you were saying somebody's right to actually choose a way to live that isn't the most helpful way for them has to be attended to all the time when you're thinking about working with adults, and that idea of happiness. What did you say? It was happiness over
safety.
Over safety. Yes. Yeah, because that's right. You can keep somebody safe and they can be really miserable. It's that saying, isn't it? This won't make you live longer, but it'll sure make you feel like you are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's so I think that she's touching on some of those tensions there. And then in her knowing side, she's talking about the kinds of knowledge and understandings that workers need in order to make sense of a complex range of contexts and dynamics which underpin communication with clients. And I want to come back to that one because I think this is one of the key areas of difference between us and counselling that we need to think about. And then doing, well, doing's the kind of techniques and micro skills which workers might need, such as age-appropriate language, knowledge of specific issues, active listening, engagement skills, approaches such as motivational interviewing, or indeed, counselling skills.
That's really interesting, actually, because that being, knowing and doing highlights that knowledge and skills aren't enough, because that's just the knowing and doing, that you also need the values and to be alongside people, and you don't rush in and just I know what's going on and I know I'm going to do something. You actually want to be present with the person to understand what it's like for them first.
I read something the other day that keeps really resonating with me, and it's this: we are called human beings, not human doings.
So we wanted to talk a bit about how counselling compares to social work and some of the differences that you've already kind of touched on. And the first one, I think, is this idea of intention, which is partly linked to the idea of some people being voluntary in social work and some not, and in counselling them generally being voluntary. Because if we're, I guess both professions are thinking about supporting people to change, and in social work, some of that need for change comes from society, comes from legislation or mandate, because of the impact on society overall, or the fact that we might maybe don't like it, our kind of cultural issues with things around people's lifestyles. And so it's not necessarily the case that the person themselves has the same view of what change is needed and why as society does or other people do, and we might come in with a bit of tension there.
And indeed, often for a social worker, when we go in to talk to a family, it's one of the first times that they've been told or that they've been asked to think about what they're doing as problematic and needing change. Whereas in counselling, most people come to counselling at a level of discomfort already. Does that make sense? They're already uncomfortable about how they're experiencing life and they're actually being driven into action. Whereas sometimes in social work, the driver is from somebody else's perception of the lived life of the individual.
And it's probably worth then mentioning this issue of time here, because if we've got different ideas about the necessity of change, we might also have different views of how quickly that change needs to happen. And that could work either way, couldn't it? You could have someone coming to social services saying, I feel like I'm in crisis and I need support right now. And then we take our time because we can't deliver it. But equally, you might have somebody who needs a while to work out what's going on and for us to identify effective ways of changing, and actually we're told we've got to do it quicker than that. And I guess that those tensions maybe arise in counselling to some extent, but the more the person coming to change sets the pace, I guess the more likely it is that the time will be right.
My observation from having worked in social care since the late 80s is that it's almost impossible to sustain meaningful change without a person-centered approach that's grounded in counselling and relationships. People really need to believe in their own abilities to make a difference in their life, and they need to be able to utilise new ways of managing conflict and stress and the difficulties, or what Margot Sunderland actually calls suffering well. And this really struck a chord with me. She talked about this as the ability to be able to seek out support and comfort during times of emotional pain. And this is based on the sure knowledge, actually, that all humans' journeys will contain periods of suffering. You know, the minute you enter into a relationship with somebody, you enter into a contract that gives you guaranteed suffering, really.
And joy.
And joy, no doubt. No doubt the joy. That's why you enter it. But the point is, I guess what I'm saying is we can't avoid pain in our human life, can we? We can't do that. So how we respond to that painfulness, how we respond to that suffering depends on the resources that we have, and both our internal resources and our external resources. And this kind of comes to the second point of difference about the role of social workers, is that actually we have a role in system-based change, because social work doesn't place all the responsibility for change with the individual person. And I think that this is really, really critical. The social worker seeks to manage and challenge and shift the systems around the person. It takes account of the role of poverty, housing, education, healthcare, and policy. And that's part of how the social worker responds to the client. And we need really to be thinking the whole time about how we can place the person within their context and really understand the impact of the context upon them. And can we work with them to challenge and change and use the context to contribute towards their own internal journey? So it's kind of like we take that counselling and we take the relational part and we help them build skills to manage, but we also look at what else is impacting on them from the outside. And we have a mandate, I believe, as social workers to actually interfere isn't the right word, and perhaps you'll give me a better one, but to be involved in changing and challenging that landscape.
Yeah, we need to have an effect on the context as well, don't we? If the context is what's causing some of the suffering or stopping the person from suffering well. And actually, you've just made me think of something else, which is we support individuals through a therapeutic relationship and help them understand and take control of what they can. And we also look at the context around them. And we also work with more than one relationship at a time. So something like family group conferencing, that would also be looking at sort of spreading those therapeutic relationships and spreading the influence on the context amongst a group of people.
And hopefully we'll have lots of systemic family therapists who use counselling as their core model, jumping in at this point and saying, that's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you know, if you're a systemic family therapist, then you take that whole family network and you get them together and you look at how they're interacting with each other. A social worker adds another layer into that, actually, because we don't only take the family network, but we take the professional network. So the housing, the health, the police, the YOS, the other network, and we wrap that around as well. This is kind of case management, social work case management at its best, is when they take that systemic view and they coordinate and bring together and kind of elicit the best out of all of those relationships for the good of an individual person.
Yes. So we were going to talk about implications for practice. So we want to be explicit about the relationship and the limits of that as a healing relationship and where the potentially coercive or power elements come in, and give it time to build trust so that we can actually work through those things. And the constraint, obviously, the issue for practice is where we don't have that level of time. But trying to carve it out to some extent, as we were saying in the last podcast, you know, relationship, attending to relationship is the most important priority.
People have got to see you as part of the solution to the things that they're really struggling with.
Yeah, I mean, the other two big implications for me from this conversation are, firstly, the importance of the safe space, and thinking about, in my experience of going out and visiting people, how often the place that I was talking to them wasn't really conducive to feeling safe for talking about really private things. It might have been a hospital ward, it might have been a front room where people coming in and out, it might have been not private, or I might have made it feel unsafe by all my bits of paper, that kind of thing. So there's implications around how we create that environment. And the other implication for me from what you've just said is about the kind of the struggle and the willingness to stay with the struggle, because the temptation is to know and do and not to be. It's to try to stop the suffering and resolve the struggle, sometimes too fast.
Yep. I think that's right. And I guess, you know, I've written a little kind of story here that kind of illustrated that point, I guess, which is that idea of attending to the humanity in our work and thinking of ourselves in terms of healing and helping. You know, and I'd kind of thought, well, there's a cost actually to making judgments that have an impact on people when they're not agreed. Mm. There's a cost to us and there's a cost to the person involved. And really, it has, if it's not done sensitively and relationally using every counselling skill available, it can actually be experienced by the client as part of the system that is oppressing and incapacitating them. And it took me right back to a place where I had to pick up, I had to place a newborn baby into foster care against her mother's wishes. And I had to pick the mother up from hospital 2 days after she'd given birth and, you know, take this new little baby down and place it in the baby seat and then take mum and the baby to the foster carer and then sit with them while mum handed her baby over to another person. And I then drove her to her house, which she lived in with her partner, whom she'd chosen to go back to, even though he was on trial for the killing of their firstborn son some time ago. And really, it was really painful. And both of us, we just sat in the car, both of us just crying. And I know that some people kind of think that you shouldn't cry in front of your clients or anything like that. But we were crying together, like it wasn't I wasn't forcing myself onto her. She wasn't forcing herself onto me. It was just, it was sad. Mm. It was really sad. And afterwards, because I continued to work with that mum for about a year after, we were able to visit some of that trauma and distress that she was experiencing in having lost two of her children. And how I was able to do that, because I was thinking, how do we manage to do this? How do we manage to use counselling and have that kind of power imbalance? And for me, I was able to use supervision to explore the distress and trauma that I felt in my role for her grief. Mm. Because I felt I did have a role in it. And so I was able to focus on the vulnerability of the child and the need for the child's security and safety, predictability and warmth that she required, that in my professional judgment, I don't think she would have got in her biological parents' home. So my supervisor used his counselling skills to support me through that and to help me suffer well. And that allowed me to go back to the mother and continue to be available to witness her suffering and anger and to keep being open to that relationship.
There is an implication there, isn't there, that if we're going to be able to offer this kind of being with people, that we need to have people to be with as well.
No question.
We need that supervision and support ourselves.
Yeah. But if we now frame that into what I think the second difference is, which is our systemic or our systems-based approach, and think about her as a woman experiencing domestic violence in a long-term relationship that social care and the police alleged had led to the death of her young child, actually her choices to her seemed very limited. For her, each decision she could make was marked with lost and unknown. And part of the social work response was to find a way of challenging this context. Part of social work is to keep talking about this stuff and to keep talking about people's experience in their contexts and keep challenging that.
It's a couple of reflective points, and they're both drawing from the kind of the roots, I suppose, of counselling. So if we think of counsellors as wisdom or advice, and in counselling that's really people drawing on their own wisdom that works for them and their own drawing on their own counsel, how do we help people to acquire wisdom from themselves and from their networks that will work for them? And the other is the kind of root of therapy as healing, and do we think of ourselves as healing professionals in that sense?